Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Women's History Month 2018 is coming to an end. Today's program goes back to the beginning, to Seneca Falls, 1848, 170 years ago. The Meaning of Seneca Falls by Gerda Lerner. In 1848, according to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, a specter was haunting Europe, the specter of communism. In that same year, the upstate New York village of Seneca Falls hosted a gathering of more than 300 people, earnestly debating a declaration of sentiments to be spread by newsprint and oratory. The Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention marked the beginning of the women's rights movement. The specter that haunted Europe developed into a mighty movement, embracing the globe, causing revolutions, wars, tyrannies, and counter-revolutions. Having gained state power in Russia, China, and Eastern Europe, 20th century communism in 1948 seemed more threatening a specter than ever before. Yet, after a bitter period of Cold War, which pitted nuclear nations against one another in a futile stalemate, it fell of its own weight in almost all its major centers. The small spark figuratively ignited at Seneca Falls never produced revolutions, usurpation of power, or wars. Yet it led to a transformation of consciousness and a movement of empowerment on behalf of half the human race, which hardly has its equal in human history. Until very recently, the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 was not recognized as significant by historians, was not included in history textbooks, not celebrated as an important event in public schools, never mentioned in the media or the press. In the 1950s, the building where it was held, formerly the Wesleyan Chapel, was used as a filling station. In the 1960s, it housed a laundromat. It was only due to the resurgence of modern feminism and the advances of the field of women's history that the Seneca Falls Convention has entered the nation's consciousness. The establishment of Women's History Month as a national event during the Carter administration and its continuance through every administration since then has helped to educate the nation to the significance of women's role in history. Still, it took decades of struggle by women's organizations, feminist historians, and preservationists to rescue the building at Seneca Falls, and finally to persuade the National Park Service to turn it into a historic site. Today, it is a major tourist attraction and has been enhanced by the establishment of a National Women's Hall of Fame on the site. This history of long forgetting and short remembering, and that's a quote, has been an important aspect of women's historic past, the significance of which we only understood as we began to study women's history in depth. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the great communicator and propagandist of 19th century feminism, has left a detailed account of the origins of the Seneca Falls Convention, both in her autobiography and in the monumental History of Women's Suffrage. The idea for such a meeting originated with Stanton and with Lucretia Mott when they both attended the 1840 World Anti-Slavery Convention in London, at which representatives of female anti-slavery societies were denied seating and voting rights. Outraged by this humiliating experience, Stanton and Mott decided in London that they would convene a meeting of women in the United States to discuss the grievances as soon as possible. But her responsibilities as mother of a growing family intervened, and Stanton could not implement her plan until 1848, when Lucretia Mott visited her sister, Martha Wright, in Waterloo, a town near Seneca Falls. There, Stanton met with Mott, her hostess Jane Hunt, and their friend Mary Ann McClintock. Stanton wrote, "I poured out that day the torrent of my long accumulating discontent with such vehemence and indignation that I stirred myself as well as the rest of the party to do or dare anything." The five women drafted an announcement for a women's rights convention to be held at Seneca Falls on the 19th and 20th of July, 1848, and placed the notice in the local paper and the abolitionist press. The five women who issued the call to the Seneca Falls Convention were hardly as naive and inexperienced as later somewhat mythical versions of the events would lead one to believe. Lucretia Mott was an experienced and highly acclaimed public speaker, a Quaker minister, and longtime abolitionist. She had attended the founding meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1833, which admitted women only as observers. She was a founder of the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society and its long-term president. The fact that she was announced as the principal speaker at the Seneca Falls Convention was a distinct drawing card. Elizabeth Cady Stanton's long accumulated discontent, and that's a quote from her, had to do with her struggle to raise her children. She would later have four more, and run a large household in the frequent absences of her husband, Henry, a budding lawyer and free soil politician. Still, she found time to be involved in the campaign for reform of women's property rights in New York State, where a reform bill was passed just prior to the convention, and she had spoken before the state legislature. Martha Wright, Jane Hunt, and Mary Ann McClintock were all separatist Quakers, long active in working to improve the position of women within their church. All of them were veterans of reform and women's organizations and had worked on anti-slavery fairs. The place where they held their convention was particularly suited for attracting an audience of radical thinkers. The region had for more than two decades been the center of reform and utopian movements, largely due to the economic upheavals brought by the opening of the Erie Canal and the ensuing competition with Western agriculture, which brought many farmers to bankruptcy. Economic uncertainty led many to embrace utopian schemes for salvation. The region was known as the Burned Over District because so many schemes for reform had swept over it in rapid succession, from evangelical revivalism to temperance, abolition, Mormonism, and the Chiliastic movement that predicted the second coming of Christ with precision for October 12, 1843. The men and women who gathered in the Seneca Falls Wesleyan Chapel were not a national audience. They all came from upstate New York and represented a relatively narrow spectrum of activists. Their local background predisposed them to accept radical pronouncements and challenging proposals. Most of them were abolitionists, the women having been active for nearly 10 years in charitable reform and anti-slavery activities. They were experienced in running petition campaigns, and many had organized anti-slavery fundraising fairs. Among the men who attended, several were local lawyers with the Liberty Party or Free Soil affiliations. Also present and taking a prominent part in the deliberations was Frederick Douglass, the former slave and celebrated abolitionist speaker, now editor of the North Star. Far from representing a group of inexperienced housewives running their first public meeting, the majority of the convention participants were reformers with considerable organizational experience. For example, Amy Post and six other women from Rochester, New York, who came to Seneca Falls, were able to organize a similar women's rights convention in Rochester 2 weeks later. One of the significant aspects of the Seneca Falls Convention is that it was grounded in several organizational networks that had already existed for some time and could mobilize the energies of seasoned reform activists. Most of the reformers attending had family, church, and political affiliations in other areas of the North and Midwest. It was through them that the message of Seneca Falls spread quickly and led to the formation of a national movement. The first truly national convention on women's rights was held in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1850. By 1860, 10 national and many local women's rights conventions had been organized. The first day of the Seneca Falls meetings was reserved to women, who occupied themselves with debating paragraph by paragraph a declaration of sentiments prepared by Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Resolutions were offered, debated, and adopted. At the end of the second day, 68 women and 32 men signed their names to the Declaration of Sentiments, which embodied the program of the nascent movement and provided a model for future women's rights conventions. The number of signers represented only a third of those present, which probably was due to the radical nature of the statement. the inequities cited and the demands raised in this declaration were not entirely novel. Like all major social and intellectual movements, feminism has many and diverse antecedents. By selecting the Declaration of Independence for their formal model and following its preamble almost verbatim, except for the insertion of gender-neutral language, the organizers of the convention sought to base their main appeal on the democratic rights embodied in the nation's founding document. They also put the weight and symbolism of this revered text behind what was in their time a radical assertion. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal," unquote. The feminist appeal to natural rights and the social contract had long antecedents on the European continent, the most important advocate of it being Mary Wollstonecraft. Her work was well known in the United States, where the same argument had been well made by Judith Sargent Murray, Frances Wright, Emma Willard, Sarah Grimke, and Margaret Fuller. The second fundamental argument for the equality of women was religious. As stated in the Declaration, "Resolved that woman is man's equal was intended to be so by the Creator, and the highest good of the race demands that she should be recognized as such. And one of the grievances is he, man, has usurped the prerogative of Jehovah himself, claiming it as his right to assign her to a sphere of action when that belongs to her conscience and her God." The feminist argument based on biblical grounds can be traced back for 700 years prior to 1848, but the women assembled at Seneca Falls were unaware of that fact because of the non-existence of anything like women's history. They did know the Quaker argument, especially as made in her public lectures by Lucretia Mott. They had read Sarah Grimke's Letters on the Equality of the Sexes, and several of the resolutions, in fact, followed her text. They also knew of the biblical argument by Ann Lee of the Shakers, and they echoed the anti-slavery biblical argument, applying it to women. The Declaration of Sentiments departed from precedent in its most radical statement. "The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her," quote, unquote. The naming of man as the culprit, thereby identifying patriarchy as a system of tyranny, was highly original, but may have been directed more by the rhetorical flourishes of the Declaration of Independence than by an actual analysis of women's situation. When it came to the list of grievances, the authors departed from the text and became quite specific. Women had been denied her inalienable right to the elective franchise, quote unquote. She had no voice in the making of laws. She was deprived of other rights of citizenship. She was declared civilly dead upon marriage, deprived of her property and wages, discriminated against in case of divorce and in payment for work. Women were denied equal access to education and were kept out of the professions, held in a subordinate position in church and state, and assigned by man to the domestic sphere. Man has endeavored to destroy women's self-respect and keep her dependent. They concluded that in view of the disenfranchisement of one half the people of this country, quote, "we insist that women have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of the United States," unquote. It has been claimed by historians and by herself that Stanton's controversial resolution advocating voting rights for women, the only resolution not approved unanimously at the convention, was her most important original contribution. In fact, Sarah and Angelina Grimke had advocated women's right to vote and hold office in 1838, and Frances Wright had done so in the early 1830s. It was not so much the originality as the inclusiveness of the listed grievances that was important. The Declaration claimed universality, even though it never mentioned differences among women. Future women's rights conferences before the Civil War would rectify this omission and pay particular attention to the needs of lower class and slave women. While grievances pertaining to women's sexual oppression were not explicitly included in the Declaration of Sentiments, they were very much alive in the consciousness of the leading participants. Elizabeth Cady Stanton had already in 1848 begun to include allusions to what we now call marital rape in her letters, and soon after the Seneca Falls Convention made such references explicit, calling on legislatures to forbid marriage to drunkards. She soon became an open advocate of divorce and of the right of women to leave abusive marriages. Later women's rights conventions would include some of these issues among their demands, although they used carefully guarded language and focused on abuse by, quote, drunkards, unquote. This was a hidden feminist theme of the mainstream women's temperance movement in the 1880s and caused many temperance women to embrace woman suffrage. What we now call a woman's right to her body was already on the agenda of the 19th century women's rights movement. It was the confluence of a broad-ranging programmatic declaration with a format familiar and accessible to reformers that gave the event its historical significance. The Seneca Falls Convention was the first forum in which women gathered together to publicly air their own grievances, not those of the needy, the enslaved, orphans, or widows. The achievement of a public voice for women and recognition that women could not win their rights unless they organized made Seneca Falls a major event in history. What progress has been made in the status of women since 1848? It is useful to think of women's demands as encompassing two sets of needs, women's rights and women's emancipation. Women's rights essentially are civil rights to vote, to hold office, to have access to education and to economic and political power at every level of society on an equal basis with men. They include property rights, the rights to one's earnings, the right to sue and be sued, the right to dispose of property. These rights are demanded on the basis of a claim to equality. As citizens, as members of society, women are by rights equal and must therefore be treated equally. All of the rights here listed are based on the acceptance of the status quo. All women ask is to be admitted to it on a basis of equality. These are essentially reformist demands. Women's emancipation is freedom from oppressive restrictions imposed by reason of sex, self-determination, and autonomy. Oppressive restrictions are biological restrictions due to sex, as well as socially imposed ones. Thus, women's bearing and nursing children is a biological given, but the assignment to women of the major responsibility of the rearing of children and for housework is socially imposed. Self-determination means being free to decide one's own destiny, to define one's own social role. Autonomy means earning one's status, not being born into it or marrying it. It means financial and cultural independence, freedom to choose one's own lifestyle, regardless of sex. It means freedom to define issues, roles, laws, and cultural norms on an equality with men. The demands of emancipation are based on stressing women's difference from men, but also on stressing women's difference from other women. They are radical demands, which can only be achieved by transforming society for men and women, equalizing gender definitions for both sexes, assigning the reproductive work of raising the next generation to both men and women, and reorganizing social institutions so as to make such arrangements possible. Women, just like men, are placed in society as individuals and as citizens. They are both equal and different. The demand for women's emancipation always includes the demands for women's rights, but the reverse is not true. Generally speaking, women's rights have been won or improved upon in many parts of the world since 1848. Women's emancipation has not yet been won anywhere. The movement started at Seneca Falls called itself the Woman's Rights, embracing both concepts, that of the individual woman as a person and as a citizen demanding rights. As we have seen, its program from the start embraced both by demanding legal, property, civil rights, and by demanding changes in gender role definition and in women's rights to her own body. As the 19th century movement matured, there developed some tension between advocates of these two different sets of demands, with the mainstream focusing more and more on legal and property rights, while radicals and outsiders, like sex reformers, birth control advocates, and socialist feminists, demanded more profound changes. The 20th century women's movement adopted the plural, women, to show inclusiveness and to reflect the fact it was a broadly based coalition building movement. But the same distinctions and tensions as in the first wave of feminism have appeared in the new feminism that started in the 1960s. One wing focused mainly on women's rights, adoption of the equal rights movement, legal, political rights and representation, and civil rights for women of different classes, races, and sexual orientation. The other wing began as a radical women's liberation, that's a quote, and later branched off into many more specialized groups working on abortion rights, protection of women against violence and sexual harassment, the opening up to women of non-traditional occupations, self-empowerment, and the creation of women's cultural institutions, ranging from lesbian groupings to women's music festivals and pop culture. The two informally defined wings of the movement often overlapped, sometimes collaborated on specific narrow issues, and recently have worked more and more on bridge building. The women's studies movement has struggled hard to encompass them educationally. Further, new forms of feminism by women of color or women who define themselves as different from the majority in various ways have sprung up and served their own constituencies. Their existence has not weakened the movement, as its critics like to claim, but has strengthened it immensely by grounding it more firmly in different constituencies. Let us not forget ever that when we talk about women's rights, we talk about the rights of half the human race. No one expects all men to have the same interests, issues, or demands. We should therefore never expect women to have one agenda, one set of issues or demands. The women's rights demands first raised at Seneca Falls have, in the United States, been generally achieved for middle-class white women. They have been partially achieved for working-class women and women of color, but progress has been very uneven. The continuing horrendous gaps in life expectancy, infant mortality, and survival rates between white and African-American women is but one illustration of this unevenness. The progress on economic issues, such as equal wages, equal access to credit, equal treatment in home ownership, and insurance availability, has also varied by class and race, with much remaining to be done. The feminization of poverty and the increasing income gap between the rich and the poor have turned many legal gains won by women into empty shells. An example is the way in which legal restrictions on women's rights to choose abortion have fallen on poor women than on the well-to-do. The uneven availability of childcare for working mothers is another example. The cultural transformation on which demands for women's emancipation build has been enormous. Many demands that seemed outrageous in 1848 are now commonly accepted, such as a woman's right to equal guardianship of her children, to divorce, to jury duty, to acceptance in non-traditional occupations. Female police and fire officers and female military personnel are accepted everywhere without question. Women's participation in competitive sports is another area in which progress has been great, though it is far from complete. Many other feminist demands that seemed outrageously radical even 30 years ago have become commonplace today. The acceptance of lesbians as normal members of the community, single motherhood, the criminal character of sexual harassment and marital rape. The acceptance of such ideas is still uneven and different in different places, but generally the feminist program has been accepted by millions of people who refuse to identify themselves as feminists. What critics decry as the splintering and diffusion of the movement is actually its greatest strength today. It should be recognized that the aims of feminism are transformative, but its methods have been peaceful reform, persuasion, and education. Since Seneca Falls, feminists have organized, lobbied, marched, petitioned, put their bodies on the line in demonstrations, and have overcome ancient prejudices by heroic acts of self-help. Whatever gains were won had to be won step by step, over and over again. Nothing was given to women. Whatever gains we made, we had to earn. And perhaps the most precious right we have won in these two centuries is the right to know our own history, to draw on the knowledge and experience of the women before us, to celebrate and emulate our heroines, and finally to know that greatness is not a sexual attribute. The fact that it took 72 years of organized effort for American women to win the vote shows that social transformation and legal change is a slow process. The women who launched the small movement in 1848 had to learn to stay with it for nearly four generations. They had to build, county by county, state by state, the largest grassroots movement of the 19th century, and then build it again in the 20th century to transform right to vote into the right to equal representation. Seneca Falls and the movement it spawned show that legal changes, hard-won though they are, remain useless and can be reversed unless social and cultural transformations sustain them. The feminist program proclaimed at Seneca Falls spoke to vast constituencies of women. The worldwide movement of women for their rights and emancipation has steadily progressed and is irreversible, although of necessity, it has progressed at an uneven rate due to different historical and cultural conditions in different countries. The grievances listed at Seneca Falls have been resolved or at least dealt with, though new inequities arise in each generation. Communism, the specter that haunted Europe, and that's a quote from Engels and Marx, in 1848 left some gains, but mostly bloodshed, terror, and devastation in its wake, and most of its inequities it sought to adjust are still with us. Feminism has behind it a record of solid gains without the costs of bloody war and revolution. Although the media and many politicians with monotonous frequency declare feminism to be dead, many of its goals have been accomplished and its momentum worldwide is steadily rising. It will continue to live and grow as long as women anywhere have grievances they can proclaim and as long as they are willing and able to organize to rectify them. And that was The Meaning of Seneca Falls by Gerda Lerner. Gerda Hedwig Lerner was a historian, writer, and teacher, and pioneer of women's studies. She wrote poetry, fiction, and screenplays, and published several books on women's history, among them Why History Matters and The Feminist Thought of Sarah Grimke. While an undergraduate student in 1963 at the New School of Social Research, she taught Great Women in American History, which is considered the first regular college course in women's history taught anywhere. She served as president of the Organization of American Historians in 1980 and 1981. Born in Austria in 1920, she died in 2013 at the age of 92. She wrote The Meaning of Seneca Falls for the fall 1998 issue of Descent magazine, which was the 150th anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention. And as a bit of an epilogue, the conjunction of Easter with April Fool's Day seems an almost too convenient metaphor for the chaotic age of Trump we are agonizing through, with a former playmate bunny added to the muddle. All the more bizarre, a nude statue of Donald Trump is up for auction. This seems to be the first time April Fools and Easter converge since 1945, which, if anyone might remember, is the year the nuclear age and the America century began. Does this now portend the end of a three-quarter century reign and perhaps humanity? Is there any prevalent significance that on April Fool's Day 1929, which was the day after Easter that year, known as Easter Monday, the yo-yo first appeared, the same year of the stock market crash and the Great Depression? Does that traject to the present yo-yo in the White House? By the way, Easter Monday is the day when the White House holds its annual egg roll, perhaps hosted this year by a Playboy bunny. And thanks for your enlightened and sensible generosity this past spring pledge drive. As any astute citizen is aware, public media is becoming ever more a necessity in the realm of veracity and democracy in this extremely dangerous period of prevarication and salacious mendacity. This is Michael McCusker. Happy Fool's Paradise Day.